This is CliffCentral.com.
We've got Justice Malala here. It is time for the Burning Platform and time for us to check in on all the big stories that I know you can't wait to ask Justice about, that he can't wait to tell us about. And there's always something controversial going on thanks to the politicians. So, here he is. Justice, how are you?
Very good. How are you guys?
Good, fine. You seem perturbed that Ben isn't here this morning.
I am a bit.
He's at some golf thing.
Jeez, I'm in the life of the rich and famous.
I know, totally.
Talking about rich and famous. So you guys were in London, then I see you're hanging out with Obama. I can't keep up anymore.
Sia was, he's so superior, you know. Sia has such a superiority complex. He was at Obama's, his lecture on Tuesday, but in the media suite. Last night he went to the Katy Perry concert. VVIP diamond tickets.
My word. Not VIP.
VV.
So, you know, I mean, some of us get VIP once a year.
Usually to the...
Excuse me, I am not off on a holiday every 2 seconds, Mr. Malala. So
are you feeling better at least? Because last time we spoke to you, you were in the best of health.
I'm feeling slightly better, but I still have whatever I had. It's lingering, but it's all good.
You brought up Obama. Did you listen to his lecture? Because it's been the subject of quite a lot of news reporting internationally and locally. I tried to take in as much of it as possible. He gave us a very nice historical context.
Yeah.
He went into where we're at, how the world really is better, but how he's concerned that in some places it's going backwards.
Yeah, I listened to it, and I'm always interested when someone revered like that stands up and speaks to, you know, many of the people in that stadium, you know, part of the 1%, part of that very thin slither of society at the very top, and I think, you know, many of us are part of that, but I think that speech was two parts to us here, and second part to the rest of the world and to global politics. Mm-hmm. It was interesting for me how it was covered, say, in the U.S., where Donald Trump had said one thing in his press conference with Vladimir Putin. The next day, 17 hours later, was saying, no, I said would when I meant wouldn't. Or did he say, I wanted to say
but,
wouldn't
but he's,
when I
he's
said
he's now
would.
Come up with a third version. No, just this morning, there's a new correction to the story. Dear. So I don't know what Donald Trump means. I think he suddenly, this is the first time in his presidency where his own side have had very critical things to say about him.
Yeah.
So I think he was quite vulnerable for the first time.
A man on fire there. Mm. So for me, there were several things which I think we should here in South Africa and elsewhere think about. When he spoke about democracy, and I think he spoke about strongman politics, about the emergence of, I'll do it myself and I'll do it without the will of the people. Mm-hmm. He didn't speak about Trump, but Trump has been going around praising people like Putin and Kim Jong-un and Duterte
in the Philippines
and people like that. And I think he was just saying, you know, don't undermine what democracy is and what it is, and warning against this sort of admiration. I mean, here on this continent, we love Paul Kagame of Rwanda, and I'm a big fan myself. But we mustn't stop saying what happened to democratic principles here. What happened to you and I, the kind of stuff we say here, the kind of stuff we get away with saying because we live in a really free society. These are things that are precious for us, for our society, for our children. And so I thought elites on this continent could grapple a little bit more with whether democracy here on our continent is working as well as it should, and whether in some parts we're not falling back a bit. Emmerson Mnangagwa, you know, we all say, wow, he's amazing, he's fantastic, and he's the new not Mugabe. But is he really?
No difference for the ordinary
Zimbabweans.
Can't feel a difference at all.
Exactly. You know, Cameroon, English speaking Cameroonians, you know, under fire from French speaking Cameroonians and the government. In Burundi, you have a guy who's going for 20 more years as the leader of the country. So I think on this continent, you know, I spoke to a Nigerian TV station who said, oh yes, this is amazing and fantastic and so forth. But when you talk about these things, about, let's constantly revisit what democracy means for us and whether we don't sometimes hanker for, yeah, we need someone who will...
Someone who's going to solve... A savior.
Yeah, our savior.
And in some ways, inviting Obama here is a bit of savior carrying on. You know, we think he's going to come in and give us the advice that we need to
exactly.
get things right.
When
we don't trust ourselves.
It's right in front of us. We should be talking about these things ourselves. So,
interestingly, Justice, sorry to interrupt you, but Jabulani Ndebele said something very interesting and quite revealing in his introductory remarks. He said, we have to reset the ideals back to what the ideals of Mandela were and fight off and fend off the depredations of the last 10 years, which is quite a strong statement from an NGO like the Nelson Mandela Foundation, which we know has massive clout internationally. Look at all the people who they did manage to wrangle over the last 16 lectures to come here.
No, absolutely.
And quite a strong statement from him about the Zuma administration and what it's done to the fabric of society.
I think Professor Njabulani Ndebele is one of those people. He speaks gently, he speaks quietly, but he speaks powerfully. You know, I Obama was supposed to start, I think, at 2:45. Only started more than 45 minutes later.
Well, because Grasa Michelle couldn't shut up.
Exactly. But you listen to Njabulani Ndebele, short, sharp, to the point. And that was the point he made, of all those points, powerfully, that the past 10 years have taken us. Someone said, you know, we need a true north. We'd veered off so spectacularly from our direction, from where we were headed, that we were sitting there, lost, almost lost. And to reset, to come back to who we are and what we really need to be is something that's necessary. So I that was a direct shot across the bows of the Zuma administration, and you know, it was quite sad to see Jacob Zuma speaking and saying, he said yesterday that Nelson Mandela you know, carved a path for us to follow. If anyone moved off that path, it was him in the past 10 years.
And then of course this always brings about the opportunity for people, pariahs on the outside, to criticize Mandela. And I saw Ridi Tlabi getting very angry on Twitter about people who she thinks would have somehow said that they preferred war as an idea to civil war, to the idea of the compromises of 1994, which is insane. I mean, it's insane. I'm totally on Ridi's side on this.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. But, you know, we're living through a period of... there used to be, in the early 90s, the government, I think, said, oh, we need more cops. So they went around and saying, do you have a job? And see, I would say, no, I don't have a job. And they'd say, come, we'll train you. They call them get constables.
Yes.
Gets, it's instant, right? In Africa.
Yeah.
It was like, I think you went for 2 weeks or 3 weeks training and suddenly I'm a cop. Yes. So people go around with this, these gets revolutionaries, these instant revolutionaries who suddenly believe that they can say a man who spent 27 years in prison was a sellout.
Do you know what I say? They've got struggle envy, first of all, because they weren't part of the obvious moral fight that their parents took on. And in many cases, they're envious of that because they don't really have the honor that the great stalwarts of that generation had, and the moral superiority that they encompassed. And second of all, as you say, they instantly, they use completely detached and non-contextual handles to explain the situation in the 90s. There was so much that had to be so carefully dealt with. There were things there, there were forces at work that, unless you read history, which I doubt very many of these instant revolutionaries do, unless you read that history very carefully, you're never going to understand how difficult it was.
But the key thing is this, to think that, you know, to turn around and say Mandela and his generation and so many others were sellouts, or, you know, they gave away so much and so forth and all this stuff. What I find amazing is just think through, what we have that are challenging in this society. You could stand up for free quality education. Mm-hmm. You could stand up for better healthcare provision. There is so much to stand up and say, these are the things that Mandela spoke about, and Mandela and his comrades spoke about, that we nowhere near fulfilling. Let's fix them. If you try to rewrite the successes of Mandela and his comrades and his colleagues, then you are once again looking for a cause when a cause is right in front of you. Mm-hmm. Deal with that. And so I find the conversation really actually exhausting, and just a little bit like, what am I doing actually?
You and Reedy and me now, and I'm sure lots of other people
many,
too.
Many people. Just on the Obama thing, talking about people who say Mandela was, you know, I thought he, but Obama said, was quite a rousing, call to action when he said, it's time to stand up, Sia. And he wasn't talking about old geezers like me. He was talking about young people. He said, this is a time to stand up for values, for the things we believe in. And I hope that, people were listening. You know, we argue a lot. People respond to this show, to us on Twitter. Mm-hmm. We get into fights, and sometimes not so many fights. But Obama made an impassioned plea, and I think this is something here in South Africa we could do, about facts, about using. He said, I might, mm-hmm. excuse me. He said, we might disagree, but let's disagree with a due recognition of the facts. If we both say, okay, we know there's global warming, the facts say this, then let's have a fight about how do we deal with this and so forth. But we live in a world where facts, objective facts, are so denigrated, so degraded, so dismissed, that we end up, it's all emotion. So you can't say the facts are 1, 2, 3. And so let's have a debate.
I loved when he brought up the facts, because it reminds a lot of people who've been arguing from a point of view of emotion, which is often, I mean, it's very justified in many cases, right?
Emotion is good, and it has to be acknowledged. We have to, but you put the facts on the table as well. You just don't walk away from fact-based argument, from evidence-based argument. You know, it's for me, particularly in policy making, if you're going to say the issue of land or the issue of so many of the issues that we debate in this country, let's put the facts on the table, and then on the basis of the facts,
yes,
let's come up with policy. But you can't make policy on emotion only. You know, we can have colloquia and stuff where we talk about emotions, about the scars of what we've gone through. But when you make law, when you make policy, when you say, this is how we're going to solve these things, put the facts on the table. So, you know, just as a basic, why don't we even have an agreement on what a land audit looks like in this country? We still talk about numbers that go back to 1948. Why aren't you putting the facts on the table and having a proper argument about, okay, on the basis of these facts, this is how you go about this.
But if you don't have the facts, you can't improve things, because how do you know when you've got to improvement?
Exactly. You can't, you know, you're not
measuring. If it's just about feelings, if we're all just saying how we feel about things, then some people are always going to be dissatisfied, and some people Absolutely. Are always going to be fine and very happy with the status quo.
Absolutely.
And your opinion and your feelings don't matter as much as the facts.
Yeah.
That's the Absolutely. Reality.
No, we all are entitled to our opinion, as
so,
they say.
Speaking of facts, and I've seen some people criticize these numbers, mostly DA people, because they don't like it. But yeah. the Ipsos poll that's just come out is making predictions about the elections that are going to take place yeah. in 2019.
Yeah.
And it's not looking good for the DA or the EFF, frankly.
No.
And the ANC must be very happy if they believe these numbers.
Yeah, you know, I thought that the DA guys have been very unhappy with these numbers, because the DA got 22% in the last elections. It got 27% in the local elections, if you take that as a reflection of mm-hmm. the national count. So for the Ipsos poll that came out, to say that the DA is at 13%.
Yo, that's a massive
big
drop.
Blow. It's a big, big blow. but you know, I was briefly involved with the Ipsos polls in the run up to the 2016 local government elections. And a lot of people said, remember, this was just soon after the polls got it wrong in the UK on Brexit, where, you know, virtually all the polls, well, except for one or two, and an outfit here in Cape Town, actually, who said, no, the Remainers are gonna lose it. And they were right. So polling all over the world has taken a hit, mm-hmm. with many people saying, nah, these are not accurate.
Fake news
and so forth. I have to say, with the Ipsos polls, they were right on the money. Tshwane, we got right. Joburg, we got right. Nelson Mandela Bay, got it right. And the rise of the DA in Cape Town, mm-hmm. absolutely on the money as well. So I, you know, these guys have form. I know that people saying, oh no, but only 3,000 people were polled and so forth. Well, I don't say it's absolute, that these are absolutely correct and right, but I think that when last year the ANC was doing 45%, we weren't raising the same issues. So I veer towards belief.
Is it fair? I mean, based on that, and I don't doubt if you say that they're credible, that's one of the reasons we like having you in here every week, because you tell us what is credible and what isn't. And if you say it's right, then let's leave that on the table. I'm happy. But then we can explain why the DA might have shrunk to this degree. And we can explain why the ANC would have grown again, right?
Yes.
There are practical reasons for
exactly.
understanding these numbers.
Yes. And I think, you know, the Ramaphosa factor is a real factor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at that stage, and it was a very homogenous stage, if you will. But when people say, I'm proud to have someone like Ramaphosa be the president of our country again, when Graça Machel says, Nelson Mandela must be smiling,
yeah.
To have you to hear me say President Cyril Ramaphosa, you know that there is something has moved, and it's a positivity for the ANC, or a happiness at Ramaphosa's.
Or a desperate hope because of the misery of what we've come out of.
Exactly.
I mean, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed is king.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And a lot of people do say that, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa is not particularly the best of the best, but in the constellation you have in the ANC, my word, he looks like gold. He is genius. He is absolutely top dollar.
Right.
So that is where we are. So, one, the Ramaphosa effect is real, and so would bump up the ANC's numbers somewhat. There was another poll that came out about 3 months ago, which was interesting for me, where Ramaphosa's approval rating was something like 76%, and the ANC or when they asked the question, would you vote for the ANC? Only 52% said, I'd vote for the ANC. So Ramaphosa is up there at 76 and it's, whoa, man, you know, this is the guy, this. And then would you vote for his party?
But also, you know, it's very dangerous for people to homogenize anybody because we have an urban black middle class who feel very differently to a rural, you know, KwaZulu-Natal kind of tribal, more sort of King Goodwill Zwelithini type thinking people. You can't really put people into the categories that we once used to. And the people who voted ANC for, you know, while Zuma was president, are very different to the kind of people who would vote for Cyril Ramaphosa. No.
There'll always be a big middle ground there, and then there'll be shifts, and urban, particularly urban shifts, and that rural shift, whether in KZN, President Zuma remains a force.
Yeah, he remains powerful, and he's troublemaking there as well.
No, absolutely. So for me, the key thing is, the DA needs to think seriously about that 13%. It needs to think seriously about that 13%. I've been trying the past few months to think about the DA and what is in the news stream about the DA. And without doubt, when we talk about the DA on this show now, we talk about the DA and Patricia de Lille. Mm-hmm. We have the DA in Gauteng might be calling for those implicated in the life as Dimeni stuff, which the DA, Jack Bloom, actually called for, was the first politician to stand up and say, a horrific, horrific thing is happening here. He called it, and he called it right, and he's a hero for doing what he did.
I agree. But we don't talk about him.
We don't talk about...
We're talking about Patricia and Musi and Helen's tweets.
Exactly. And the DA needs to realize that, actually, what's happened the past year and its dilly-dallying, obsession, inability to act forwards, backwards on Patricia de Lille is beginning to define the DA. And I think it will take a hit on that basis. So I think of in that poll, the people who really have to think deep and hard about what this means is that you have a Ramaphosa who many people say, oh, he's got more gravitas than Musi. He's lovely. He speaks well. He's so beautiful. He's a businessman like us. So the ebb and shift that the DA was experiencing somehow, maybe under threat from that, but chiefly the fact that the DA seems to not be relentlessly focused on its core message is something they need to think about.
Don't they need that strategic spin doctor type person who, was it Ryan Kutsia who used to do that stuff for them?
Yeah.
I think that's where they've fallen off the wagon. They don't have someone wrangling all of the messaging into one, because that was what scored them a lot of the points they did when they started to grow at the polls, is people knew what they stood for. People knew what they were voting for. There were a lot more women in terms of representation. The DA has gone astray.
It's gone astray. It lacks focus. It lacks focus. Mm. And Jacob Zuma's departure has exposed that lack of focus.
Right.
So it needs to return, if you will,
right,
to being relentlessly focused. Say what you will about the EFF. The EFF's number here is 7%. Compared to where they were in 2014, that's not a drop. In 2014, they got 6.35.
Right, it's an increase.
At least they are holding steady, even with the Ramaphosa return.
Yeah.
Remember, Ramaphosa takes over. Their big nemesis, their chief nemesis was Jacob Zuma. And with Ramaphosa coming in, they still have, agree or disagree, they still have land, for example. Mm-hmm. And they're relentless and focused on that sort of thing. A few others around that. So for them, it's a huge setback that they're not growing, but they're not losing either. Whereas if you look at all the other parties, I mean, I think COPE will return zero this time. I think that Bantu Holomisa is somewhat, you know, okay, but not much.
I think people are thinking of him like an elder statesman now. They're not thinking of him as a serious political contender.
No, absolutely. They think of him as more like, oh, you know, that's a nice person, but not oh, you know, I'm going to give him my vote for a particularly compelling reason. So I think the DA of the top three, in fact, across the spectrum, is the party that has to think very seriously about its messaging.
Yeah.
Because I think it's taking a hit on where we are.
Can we, while we're talking about the DA, just focus on Solim Simanga quickly? Because he seems to be one of the better people in the DA when it comes to having direction and purpose. And certainly everybody had high hopes for him in Tshwane. How much of that he's achieved, I don't yet know. The jury's still out. It's now been a couple of years. Time moves that fast. It's a couple of years already.
I know.
But he seems to be making some very strange appointments. You always criticize the ANC for just doing cadre deployment and putting a whole lot of really incompetent people into positions. And then I hear that Solim Simanga's hired this Okump woman who lied about her qualifications, and he's got some bodybuilder working for him. I mean, what's going on there?
Yeah, it's just weird, you know. I don't know if this is, I don't know how this works, actually. You know, when you become a minister, for example, you have what is called your political office. That means that I walk in and I say, I want Sia, I want Gareth, I want Ben, and you guys can come in. Mm-hmm. You are my political office. You're civil servants. You're paid by the civil service. But the day I get fired, you guys lose your job.
Yeah.
So, same day. That's it. Let's go. So political office, who can one hire for that political office? There are guidelines to, oh, the person must be like this, the person must be like that. But at the end of the day, you're my bag man or women.
Yeah, you hire people you can trust.
Yes.
Essentially.
You can trust, you can da da da. So with Marietta Okump, that job actually was a civil service job, not a political office job. And so you have to get someone, even if you want them to be from your party, from your political outlook, you still need them to meet the minimum requirements.
To comply with those minimum requirements, right.
And that didn't happen in her case, and that's why she left. This gentleman who I won't be nasty about because he's a bodybuilder had a matric and no other qualification. What it shows in the requirements is that you had to have 10 years, I think, relevant experience, a post-school qualification proper, like a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have those. He just had a certificate in bodybuilding. So Mr. Msimanga needs to explain one thing. If this was the political office, then, you know, we can, you know, have a chat about that. But one understands that a political office, you bring your own people. That is why we had the extraordinary sight of Ms. Faith Mutambi hiring her, what do you call them?
Relatives.
Her relatives, yeah. To her political office. In fact, turns out that there were how many? 12?
Yeah, there's a lot of people.
There were a lot of
all
people.
Qualified in communications, obviously.
All of them from a small village in Limpopo or something. Anyway, so it's quite a thing. But I, you know, we talk about national politics, so I can happily say Faith Mutambi and what she did. But what's happened for me, Solim Simanga's case is, it's happening with Solim Simanga, who came in on a ticket of clean governance, and we're going to do this, and it's going to be great, and Hammanskraal is going to get water. By the way, there's no water in Hammanskraal where my mother lives.
There's no electricity in the east of Pretoria, where a lot of people are waiting for Solim Simanga to look after them too.
Exactly.
You know?
So, if that is happening with a guy with a ticket like that,
we're allowed to expect a little more.
We are allowed to, and I think that a big disappointment for him to be doing.
We do practice what I like to call the bigotry, the soft bigotry of low expectations with the ANC, because we don't expect that very much from them, but we seem to have a higher standard for the DA. But the DA themselves are responsible for that, because they've set the bar higher
for themselves.
When they disappoint, we all jump on them.
Yeah.
And of course it's not, there's no parity there, because we just have accepted that the ANC are going to be subpar in so many ways. But I do want to talk about this guy who turns out to be like he's involved in cash and transit heists, and he's in the ANC. I think he's a councillor, or he's in the, what's his position?
He's actually,
his name is Belly Present.
Can I just finish one thought on those municipalities? So
because at very least, Solly's not doing cash and transit heists. You know, well, I mean, again, the land of the blind, the one-eyed is king.
Let's just wait. can I just say on these appointments that Solim Simanga made? So, think about, we have 257 municipalities. Uh-huh. How many of them are held to account by anyone? So in
7% is solvent.
In Etegwini, the mayor met someone at the airport, and they said, "Oh, Sia is so efficient," as they were helped by Sia at a counter somewhere. And so you're going to come and work for me. And so they get put on the payroll at 50,000 rand a month as a helper to the
mayor.
When it's time to say, where are the qualifications? Exactly like Solim Simanga. Where are the qualifications? The lady disappeared. Like, I'm in trouble. Disappeared. So you have two cases. You have Solim Simanga. You have the mayor of Etegwini. And then how many others out of those 257 municipalities? And there is no way journalists, reporters, we can't cover everybody. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know how we solve this, but think of the bodybuilder and the chief of staff in Solim Simanga's office, and think of the many others across South Africa where it's essentially the same. And I can tell you now, if you were to do an audit, you would find hundreds of those kinds of people.
Scary.
So, yeah. Anyway, the ANC is Velile Present, who is now in the CAN for cash in transit heists, and for being found with quite a few stolen cars in his possession. Now, he was an employee. So he actually had an employment contract at Luthuli House. The ANC summarily dismissed him yesterday when they said they found out that he had done all these things. The story was actually broken by Herman Mashaba a few days ago. He was the first to say, "I know that there's someone who works at Luthuli House who's been involved in cash in transit heist and has been arrested by the Hawks." So, you know, it's not a happy situation for the ANC when your opponent starts getting stuff about you before you even know. For me, the interesting thing is that the ANC has done absolutely the right thing. This man has been arrested, So they say, they don't even suspend him. They fire him.
It shows you can be done.
It can be done. They fire him on the spot, and they say disciplinary processes against him, because he's a member of the ANC as well, have begun. And we are going to make sure that this man is stripped of his membership. Yay! I think it's great. It's fantastic.
Why do I sense there's a but?
But!
There we go.
The but? Yes, there is. The but for me is this. Last year, I'm a bit obsessed with this thing, but I'm not gonna stop. Last year, we had the extraordinary situation of the Deputy Minister of Higher Education, Mduduzi Manana. Mduduzi Manana beat up two women, okay? Two women at a Cubana here in Joburg.
Mm-hmm. He was convicted.
He was convicted. Thank you, God. He went to court. He was convicted, and fined for this. The ANC goes to its conference in Nazareth in December. They elect him again to the highest decision making structure of the party, the National Executive Committee.
Right.
He is, as we speak, he's in, parliament. He is your member of parliament. Okay. Has there been a disciplinary process in the ANC against him? That guy, you know, you can't beat up women. Secondly, you can't as a leader of the ANC beat up, you can't beat up women, period. But you can't as the leader of the ANC, a deputy minister. Mm-hmm. No, there hasn't been a disciplinary process. On Monday, Cyril Ramaphosa was asked a question on television, and they said, why aren't you dealing with three names you mentioned, Ace Magashule, Bathabile Dlamini, and Mduduzi Manana? Now, Bathabile Dlamini and Ace Magashule, shame. Nothing. There's not been any criminal or a conviction against them. So, you know, I understand when he said, I can't just act. But on Mduduzi Manana, He said, putting them all in one basket, that we can't act on accusations and rumors. These are not accusations and rumors. This man has been convicted. He's an NEC member of the ANC. So, you know, all I'm saying is, if you are at the top and you're powerful in the ANC, the law works differently for you to when you're just an employee. Working in security,
well,
I think.
C and I were just asking because there was a story about VBS Bank earlier. Mm. Has President Zuma paid back that money? Because now that he's off the table and he's no longer a centerpiece, people don't talk about how much money he owes or whether VBS paid on his behalf or whether he's paid them back. Or I think he's got away with it.
The loan was for 7.8 million rand.
Right.
If you buy a house for 7.8 million rand, your
repayments on your bond, what are they?
78,000 about, probably 80,000 rand a month. So President Zuma, one hopes, is paying back VBS bank, that's 80,000 rand a month. If he's not paying them back, then we need to ask, what steps have they taken to get that money back? That's one. Two, if he's paid all of it back, where did it come from? The key thing about the VBS scandal, Gareth, is that we haven't actually spoken about what happened there. What happened there was that you had a small bank with... So we'd say we're starting a Cliff Central stock fair. Every month you give me $100. CIA gives me $100. Ben gives me $100. I put in $100. And we go and put it at VBS. They had a nice thing going where lots of stock fairs in Venda, the former Venda in Limpopo. A lot of people said, this is our bank. We're going to put our stock fair money in there. So suddenly... After Jacob Zuma got that loan, there were people in the ANC going to municipalities saying, Mayor Malala and Mayor Sangweni, please put some money into this black bank. It's a good bank. Look, it even gave Jacob Zuma a loan. The law doesn't allow municipalities to put money in a mutual bank. You can only put it at a commercial bank. So these guys didn't have the license. However, these municipal managers and mayors, because they were under pressure from ANC activists and leaders, broke the law and put money in there. That's how VBS ended up having so much money. Municipalities were being leaned upon by political players to put money in there. And that money was stolen by the executives, and then it went bankrupt, and ordinary people lost their money. So Cliff Central stock fell suddenly. It's, oh, but our money's in there. Oh, sir, you can't get the money.
Mm.
So this is the real thing. So there is a line from President Zuma through to VBS and political influence there. I'm not accusing him personally of anything. I'm just saying there is a storyline there that is very interesting to watch, and we should watch it. So it will be interesting to see what happens with all those, particularly those who arrived at municipalities and said, look, the ANC wants you to put money in VBS, when the ANC probably didn't want to see it happen.
Can you tell us about this protest that is happening in Cape Town? Someone, a group, I suppose, of activists, they built a shack outside Premier Helen Zille's official residence.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, there's lots of protests. But, you know, we've just gone through, are going through one of the coldest periods in this winter. Since the beginning of July, I think, you know, it's been hovering at -1, -0. The mornings are so cold, and so forth. And I think the debates, and I'm not saying people must stop debating land and so forth, but I think the one of the biggest failures has been urban, low-income housing. So this grouping went and put up a shack outside Leeuwenhof, that's the premier's residence, whether it's Helen Zille or someone else in the future, and made a point about housing. You know, it wasn't covered much. It was a small protest. It was yesterday. Just one shack they put up next to her house. But I just think we've stopped actually having proper debates. I think the last two ministers we had in housing were really pretty poor. Lindiwe Sisulu and Tokyo Sekgala. They just didn't move the dial at all.
Mm-mm.
The key thing about Gauteng, where we are now, is that we can talk until the cows come home about land, but actually it's about people moving to the cities to seek jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And those people need to be accommodated, need to have a place to live. And so when Jacob Zuma came in, he said, I'm going to change the name from Minister of Housing to Minister of Human Settlements. Many people said, that sounds like human, whatever. And so we still don't have any idea of how have we said the city of Joburg. You know, when you go to the Market Theatre, see, I know you're a very cultural person, better than me and Gareth.
And my VVIP self.
Yes. You know, you go to shows, and I know you go to the Market Theatre to, you know, see a show every so often. One of the there's housing blocks of flats there, and those apartments are interesting for me because they are clean, beautiful, nicely built, strong, and the rent is way cheaper than the rents here in Bryanston, Sandton, and so forth. And the idea is to integrate working class families into the city. And that for me is what settlements are. You go to New York, you go to parts of London, or you go to other major cities where you have working class people living in rent controlled apartments and so forth, so that you can have people who work in the city not being excluded from the city, who mm-hmm. can live integrated into the city affordably. We've stopped having that conversation in this country, totally stopped, about how do you make sure that Mrs. Malala, who works as a domestic worker at Mr. Sangweni Finn's house, why do you want them to live in Mapetla in Soweto and take two taxis to get to your home when they can live three houses blocks down the road in a beautiful, lovely, affordable accommodation? So there are huge spaces in South Africa and many here in Bryanston where you could be building affordable housing. And it doesn't have to do anything. Oh, poor people are coming to my neighborhood. Property values will decline. No, they won't. They haven't where those places have been built in Joburg or anywhere else. New York property prices continue to go up. And it doesn't mean that poor people can't live in cities. So I think that debate in South Africa is so, we never talk about it. We don't talk about having affordable housing.
Absolutely.
In Sandton, where I can work at the spa down the road and live in Sandton, and it doesn't have to be exclusively for extremely wealthy people. That for me was what was powerful about that protest. But can also, I just say something quickly?
We were asking the other day, how do you do protest successfully these days? How do you manage to protest successfully? Because most people don't, and we saw the blocking of the highway earlier this week. Last week, we see people who protest in street marches. I don't know if that works anymore, whether politicians take any notice. You see Eskom employees who hold us to ransom with power, for example.
Yeah.
But maybe this is the way to do it, symbolically, in a powerful way.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The Eskom thing I can bang on. I am so angry about it. And I'm very angry about Eskom workers. Some of the best paid workers in this country, they're likely to get 8% increases. Worse, they threaten, and not a single person has been arrested for essentially threatening national security, threatening to bring down this country. It's no way to behave at all by any sector of this country.
Just by the way, I heard an interesting statistic yesterday. I don't, again, know who to credit in the footnotes for this one. But apparently in India's power utility, if you break it down by the amount of power generated by the staff who work for that power utility, and Eskom employee in India, by comparison, whoever the Eskom of India are, is 42 times more productive than a South African Eskom employee.
That's quite 40, a few.
42 times. I mean, that means we would have to employ 42 people to every one Indian power utility worker to generate the same amount of electricity. That is outrageous. And they want more money?
It's quite something. A lot of guys who do that sort of analysis have been pointing out that I think we've doubled the number of people at Eskom, but in the past 10 years, but we're producing less electricity than we produced then. So what's happened here? Where essentially we've
just leave it alone. It's the biggest belief.
Yeah. I just wanted to, can I end off here with just a little something for Sia? Sia, this is something I put under the shit you don't need to know about department.
Okay.
All right, let's hear it.
I wanted to tell you that a new party has been formed in KwaZulu-Natal. It's called Mazibuye African Congress. Mm. The leaders say they consulted one J.G. Zuma before they formed their party. It's a very South African party. They say they exclude white people. If you're white, you mm-hmm. can't join. I don't know. Someone should rush to the Constitutional Court with this one, because our constitution says you cannot exclude anyone on the basis of their race or color. And they say if you're Indian, you can, maybe you can join. They're not sure, but they're gonna, you know, make sure that you sit in your corner. You don't get a position. That's your new political party.
So Jacob Zuma was involved in founding this?
No, they went and consulted him.
And you consult him on what grounds exactly? Taking advice on what not to do, or...
Let's see. Don't be so cynical.
I'm just asking.
What's the party called? Asking. I want to go and try and join just to see what happens.
Mazibuye African Congress.
Do you feel like that speaks to you?
I'm going there right now, straight after the show this morning. I'm going to go and see if I can.
Look,
register.
If you need any help, you know, CNI might rustle up some application forms and stuff.
Thank
for you.
You
know?
I would appreciate that. I'm going to need all the help I can get.
I have to say, who comes up with stuff like this? Anyway, there's an election coming up next year, so you'll see more of these suddenly popping up all over the place. One of the founders, both of the founders, in fact, used to be in the ANC, then they jumped off, they went to the EFF, then they've jumped off, they are now with their own outfit. Mazibuye. African Congress.
Let's see what happens. Thanks, Justice.
Nothing's gonna happen, guys. Nothing's gonna happen.
Yeah, all right.
And you know what? I say, praise the Lord for that.
Justice Malala, the Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. Every week on a Thursday, we break down all the important stories with Justice Malala. Make sure you join us next week for more.
This is CliffCentral.com.